As David said, the reason we'd gone there was that we believed that we would be better able to move around the city in the American-held areas than the Iraqi ambulance drivers were. We'd heard a lot of Iraqi drivers coming out of Fallujah saying the ambulances had been shot at. A friend, Dr. Salam, had been wounded by a bullet, and he said the ambulance in front of his was hit by a missile fired from a plane. And so I know it does sound silly that holding your journalist pass out of the window might make a difference, but actually looking visibly foreign and holding a foreign passport out of the window does give you some protection. So we drove to the edge of no man's land, and we got out of the pickup and we walked towards where the Marines were. They were on a rooftop. We were still out of their sight. We were trying to pick up a wounded guy that was in the street. And we shouted to them, said we were an international medical team and that we wanted to pick up this person. And eventually they signaled to us that it was okay for us to come out, and we picked him up. It turned out that he was already dead, but we were able to take his body out of the street and get him to somewhere where he could be buried. And because that was successful, they then asked us to go to the hospital, which, as David said, was covered by sniper fire. So we drove the ambulance again with our passports out of the window to the second hospital, where there were a lot of wounded people that couldn't be treated properly because the hospital was operating without adequate electricity, without water, because electricity had been cut to the whole town. You can only do so much by generator, and they also weren't getting enough medical supplies in. So we were trying to move the wounded people from there to the clinic that we were working from so that they could be evacuated to Baghdad. And again, we were able to do that. And when we got back to the clinic, one of the doctors said to us, there's a pregnant woman, she's gone into labor prematurely, can you go and get her? She was in an American-held part of town, so we set out again in the ambulance. But by this time, it had got quite dark. And after we had crossed into the American-held part of town for a little while, a shot was fired at the ambulance. It was clearly marked as an ambulance. It had ambulance on the front in English and a blue flashing light and a siren. So we stopped, we turned off the siren, we held our passports up, had several more shots fired. At least one hit the body of the ambulance. It's hard to tell how many because it already had so many bullet holes in. But we also lost both of the front tires. So by the time we got back to the hospital, the front wheels were destroyed. So we couldn't use the ambulance anymore. And the doctor said to us, well, it's not your fault. You know, we'd already repaired it four times before you took it out. But we never got to her, and we don't know what happened to her. And we weren't able to do any more that night because being foreign wasn't protecting us anymore once it was dark. And what you saw there in the clinic, the young boy who had been shot, he had a head wound, a bullet wound to his head. And they came in, two children and an older woman had been hit as they tried to leave their houses in, again, an American-held part of the town. They said they'd been hit by American snipers. And both of the children died. There was no anaesthetic in the clinic. They weren't set up to operate as a hospital. It was just a doctor's clinic. The blood bags were kept in a drinks fridge. They had to be warmed up under a tap. Because there was no electricity, they were operating by generator. And generators don't run constantly. They run out of fuel or whatever. And so the generator packed up. The lights went out in the middle of the operation. And they were operating by the light of a cigarette lighter. Until David donated a torch, and then they were operating by torchlight until the generator came back on. So it was all really a very desperate situation. And the fact of not being able to move around the town meant that people also couldn't get food and water to the houses in the American-held areas. So the second day that we were there, we were asked, before we went back to Baghdad with all the wounded people from the previous day and the sick people that we'd moved from the hospital, to go to get some more sick people from a house. And they had been without food and water for some time because there were no shops operating, because they couldn't go out, because there was no water coming out of the taps. So we, again, came into no man's land and called out to the Marines and asked them to let us go to the houses. And as we got to the house, there was an old man lying face down in the road. And he'd been shot in the back. You could tell he'd been shot in the back because the bullet wound through his back was a clean wound. And then the exit wound was much more messy on his front. So he'd obviously been shot in the back and also in the neck. And he was unarmed. And his family couldn't even come out to get his body in because they were pinned to into the house by sniper fire. He'd gone out, they said, to get the vehicle to take the sick people to the hospital. So we managed to evacuate the three families on that street and also to get the family out of the house whose roof the Marines were occupying because they'd taken up a line along the rooftops. And there were 13 women and children in the one room downstairs, again, without any food or water. So we were able to get people out of the town as well. When we got to the checkpoints, we found that the soldiers had been firing what they called warning shots at people approaching, but which obviously to the people approaching felt like coming under fire. We walked up to them again, shouting through the loudspeaker that we were an international rescue team. And we managed to negotiate with them that the women and children could leave. They said no men of fighting age, but that meant that anyone between mid-teens to late 40s who was male was not allowed to leave. And that meant the drivers of essentially all of the cars, because most of the women don't drive. So we were able to then negotiate as well that one man of fighting age would be allowed to leave with his family in each car if he was the driver. And so perhaps hundreds of people were able to leave the town who wouldn't have been otherwise. And it just seems to me such a disgrace that it takes a few foreigners with no qualifications whatsoever to be able to get people out of the town, out of their houses, or to and from the hospitals. That ought to be a basic fundamental freedom for the people of the town. And it's also appalling to me that it took people like us coming out and saying that the Americans had fired at ambulances before that was really in the international media, because all of these Iraqi doctors had been saying the same thing for weeks. The Pentagon still went to the effort of calling me a liar, which I thought was quite exciting. but unequivocally, the US Marines in Fallujah shot at ambulances. I can't say in any of the other cases exactly what happened, but in that case I know that they did not come under fire from our ambulance. There were no fighters, there were no guns in our ambulance. It was a civilian ambulance going on a medical emergency mission. And nothing that the Pentagon says can change that fact. There will probably never be an exact casualty figure for Fallujah, but the sheikh of the mosque next to the clinic told us that 86 children had been killed in the first 3 days of fighting. We heard a lot of people in the refugee camp in Baghdad, of people who had left Fallujah, saying things like, our neighbour's house was hit by a missile and 25 people were killed. Those kinds of stories we were hearing all the time. It was carnage in Fallujah. There's a lot else that I want to tell you. I was in Iraq for 6 months. I was setting up links between people in the UK, in hospitals, schools, universities, and so on, and those in Iraq. I was also running a circus for 3 months. We had 4 clowns going around doing shows and playing games in the refugee camps, the squatter camps, schools, hospitals, theatres, youth centres, all of those kinds of places. And where that started from was that during the war, I was going around civilian hospitals interviewing casualties, among other projects. And there was a little boy in one of the hospitals whose house had been hit by a rocket from a US plane. And he was obviously very badly traumatized. And one of the lads that was working with me sat down on the floor next to his bed and started blowing bubbles. And Mohammed, the little boy, watched for a while, and then he put out his hand and popped one, and he smiled. And that was the first thing that had broken through all the trauma that he'd gone through. And I thought, well, if a soap bubble has that much power, what could a whole circus do? So when I got back there in November, I did have my doubts, because they needed everything. They needed blankets, they needed clean water, they needed sanitation. But people were also saying to us, we do need physical infrastructure repairs, but we need healing as well. And what we found was that wherever we went, the children were incredibly happy to see us. And the teachers said to us that before, if they gave the kids drawing materials, the kids used to draw aeroplanes dropping bombs on houses and tanks firing weapons. And after they'd seen the show, they started drawing clowns and magicians and jugglers. And so people's minds were so filled with this violence that they needed something as vivid as that to displace those images as the most vivid thing in their memory. And so what we'd find was that the adults there would also kind of edge closer and closer while we were playing games. We had this huge red piece of fabric that we played parachute games with, and the grown-ups would gradually edge closer until they were kind of helping to play parachute games. And everybody there needs to play. There's such a huge amount of depression that everybody there needs to play. And really the story about the power of a soap bubble kind of sums it up, that when you're in Iraq, it feels like no matter what you do, it's never going to be enough. But yet you see the enormous impact of something that seems really small, and it is really effective. In another of the hospitals during the war, there was a man whose son was very badly injured, and it looked like he probably wasn't going to survive. And in the midst of all of this, he said to me, "We're thanked to people in all the world, but especially England and America. More than 1 million people marched in London against the war." And probably a lot of people that went on that march later felt very disempowered because it didn't change anything, but it did change things. Because if it didn't stop the war, it made a difference to that man. When he was watching his son so badly injured, it made a difference to him to know that people all over the world, and especially in countries whose government was starting the war, that those people were saying no and those people were opposing it. So I think that going on big demonstrations still has a value because it has an impact that you can't see at home, and it makes a difference to people in Iraq and in Afghanistan who hear about it. So I think the targets for demonstrations would be particularly the arms trade, which fueled a lot of Iraq's debt and which fueled the war and which is fueling human rights abuses across the world. They're a really important target, and that pattern is being repeated now. Where Iraq was 20 years ago is where, say, Turkey is and other countries now. So taking human rights actions relating to other countries and taking action against the arms trade is one really important thing. Iraq's debt is another important issue, and I won't go into it now, but if you're interested, look at a website called jubileeiraq.org, and that's got a lot of information about the debt. And the debt is also fueling the privatization of all of Iraq's public services. So people like the IMF, the World Bank, and the creditor countries, which lent Iraq all that money to buy weapons with, are now imposing what they call structural adjustment policies. And you've seen this all over the world in countless countries, where all of the country's resources are privatized, all of the public services are privatized, so that the state is free to spend all of its income on servicing debts to rich countries and rich institutions rather than looking after its people. And so I think that's another really important thing. Also, solidarity with trade unions in Iraq. The companies from the US and the multinationals which are being given the contracts to rebuild Iraq are skimming off a huge amount of money and are treating the workers over there very badly. Particularly Stevedoring Services of America, SSA Marine, who I believe are quite nearby, Bechtel, Halliburton are all very important targets. We have to make it clear to them that their profiting from this war is not acceptable. Obviously, I'm not inciting anyone to go and pour quick-setting concrete down their toilets because that would be naughty, so don't do that. But use your imagination. I didn't say that. And I think the other important thing is to keep looking out for alternative sources of information. There's a lot of it on the internet. Look at newstandardnews.net. Look at the Iraqis who are writing weblogs. There's a lot of it about. Just search on the internet and then pass that around, because what you're getting from the news media is basically the stories of people who are not leaving their hotels and their bureaus because they're not allowed to without an armoured car. So we need to start getting the news from the Iraqis themselves. And I think that's about it.